This is HPR episode 1957 entitled, Fostum 2016 K1B and K1C. It is hosted by Ken Fallon and is about 129 minutes long. The summary is, C assert DRLM bluster overt open VZFSFE reacto Sparrows Debian PostgreSQL open Mandriver Major Gentoo.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Ken Fallon. I'm here at FOSDEM, and you may remember 2 years ago we interviewed the good folks at CA Cert. A link for that will be in the show notes. And I'm talking to one of the founders of that project. Your name is?
My name is Reinhard Mutz.
And what is your relationship with the project?
Well, I'm currently a member of the board. And my relationship to CA Cert is very simple. I entered the association in the year 2012, and I'm working with all my heart for this project to get our primary target done. And our primary target is to get audit ready. If we get an audit, then the rest will be really simple. The most difficult point is to get all documents prepared so that an external auditor has no more questions.
Yeah, just before we get into that, can you tell us a little bit briefly what CA Cert is and what you're trying to
do? Well, okay. CA Cert is an open and community-driven means that we deploy certificates for free to everybody. The main thing of a certificate is to replace in electronic commerce the normal procedure done by a manual signature. So a digital certificate will replace that manual signature. And because of this, there are a lot of requirements to consult. The main thing is, for example, that the user who gives his certificate to anybody else using email, spreading documents or something like this, is responsible for all requirements which are defined by a public key infrastructure. He says that he is the owner of the private key was never tampered, and so on. And, well, I think from my personal point of view, that's the main thing in this discussion, to make really clear to everybody. And yes, our service is free for everybody.
So this is typically used to secure transactions in a browser?
No, it's typically used to secure transactions like email, to sign documents so that a document cannot be changed afterwards. It's typically used, for example, for code signing. And the difference to SSL certificates using for browsers may be prepared by machines. And if this is done by machines only, then nobody will really certify that this is done in all cases correctly.
But you can use this to secure...
Yes, you can use it to secure your domain, domain-validated certificates we deploy. That's right, that's correct. Your next question will be, when do you enter the mainstream of the browsers? Well, the prerequisite is that we get our audit. And no audit, no integration into the browsers. That's clear.
And that work has been ongoing on that. How close are you to getting that finished?
Well, from my point of view, we should get done this latest one day before the 1st July 2017.
Okay. The introduction of the CA cert into browsers like Firefox have been held up by the fact that they didn't have a procedure, and then they sort of seem to have invented a procedure just because you asked.
Yes, that's true. There have been several tries and several attempts to to get this task done, and at least the procedures were stopped. Let's say they were stopped, and currently we have an internal auditor nominated. A lot of our procedures are checked and found to fulfill the baseline requirements, but there is a rest to do. And I don't want to talk now about this, what is to be done, because it's a team working on this.
Yeah.
But my hope is to get the biggest step done at the end of this year. And for all Europeans, we have to point out that in Europe, the project at the EU called eIDAS, you may have heard of this, will start within all 28 member states in the EU at least in 2020. With the beginning, with the 1st January of 2020, the plans are that eIDAS will be operated within all 28 member states.
And what is that now?
You know the EU?
Yes, I know.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the member states plan that they have a similar eID document for everybody, which may be which may contain a digital certificate from your country, and at least you need one machine to read them all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we hope, really hope, that we will get CSERT. Let's say, forward, we want to take part in this technology.
Yeah.
And it's not a work you will do within 5 minutes or 2 months. It's a lot of work to do, and not everybody agrees with us, and not everybody understands what is to do.
Yeah.
But, well, we see, for example, every half a year there is a presentation called the CA Day. The last two I personally attended in Berlin, because it's not very far from where I live. And you see that the European Union is working on this theme with really great power. And they are going forward, and they don't wait for everybody to keep to do the same steps at the same time. So they are pushing forwards, and we have really a lot of things to do in the work to come along with them. Yeah, and that are our plans, and I hope that the community will see us, and the community will help us. And we need help, and help is very appreciated.
Okay, contact information for your project will be in the show notes for this episode.
Yeah.
Right behind me, we have a table going. What's happening over here on the table?
That's very easy to explain. If you want to have your certificate, then you need to prove your identity. And that is what is done here. That is what we call an assurance. People come, fill out a form, talk to an assurer, and just present their official ID cards with a photocopy on it. And what we do is, we check that the information given on the form can be proved against the official ID cards. So that is true. And the second test is, what we do is, when we are home, we check that the information given on the CAP formula is the same which have been registered with CSERT by the assuree, by the candidate. So we do two checks, and if both checks are passed successfully, then the assurer will give some points, what we call assurance points. There's a ranking. The ranking is from 0 up to 100 points. If you got 50 points, you will be able to get your personal name in your certificate. So you have a personal certificate. If you got 100 points, you are able to and pass the assurer test and become an assurer yourself. So that's a great help for CSCert if you decide on your home, yes, the project is worth to do this effort, and then just go start, get your 100 points, pass your CATS test, and become an assurer. You're really welcome.
Okay, very good. But wouldn't it just be simpler to take out my credit card and go to, I don't know, VeriSign and get my cert that way?
We don't use credit cards or something like this. All you write down on the formula is your name, your date of birth, and your primary email address. And you have to register with CSCert with this email address. Every person has a singular email address, which is really unique around the world. So we know that this person is the one we met.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is how it works.
So it's every step of the way, it's a web of trust confirmed by individuals who are trusted by other individuals who are proven by documentation that they bring.
Yes, that's right.
This must be an administrative nightmare to put all this together. It's a very different way of working. I imagine that businesses who are looking at approving your certification, this is a completely different approach.
Yes, it's really a different approach. And the question of all is there a right for existence for CSCert or not? And it's my opinion, and not only my opinion, the right is derivative from the right of identity security. If you have a right to secure yourself, if you have a right, a privacy right, as commonly told, then there is a right of existence for CSCert. If not, then all other CAs can do better.
Yeah,
that's very simple. I think that is to understood, and that is my personal drive to help CSCert to get forward.
Okay, thank you very much, and hopefully there will be people listening to this that will at least contribute to your project. Thank you very much.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Can you tell me what the project is and who you are?
Okay, we are brain updaters. We are a team from Barcelona, from Spain. And we started this project because of a requirement of a big enterprise called Grifols. It's a pharmaceutical. And they had lots and hundreds of Linux systems. And they needed a tool to back up the operating system in order to disaster recovery. We use the RLM is a manager for Relax and Recover. It's a software that was made by Gradient. It's over here. There. Yeah. And this is a manager for real backups. So all the backups are stored in a server, the DRLM, and all the rear backups are stored in this server. The point is that you can recover any system booting from the network.
Okay.
You have the copies in the server, and you run the backups from the server. Also, you have a list of clients, a list of network, a list of backups, and then if you have to recover in other machine, it doesn't matter if it's virtual, is it physical, and you recover from the network.
So, is this for like client machines, or are we talking about servers only?
Servers.
Okay, so you. So how is it done?
As well on client machines, but usually,
And you run a scheduled job on the server.
Sorry?
do you run? What sort of jobs do you run? Is it always a full system backup, or is it incremental?
It's a full operational operative system backup. We separate the data from the operative system. I mean, you recover first the operative system, and then if you have databases or whatever, you can use another tool, Bakula, it doesn't matter the tool. We are focused in recover the operative system. The operative system used to have a size maybe 3 gigabytes maximum or 1 gigabyte, and it's really fast and quick to recover the system. 5-10 minutes to recover a server.
And does the server have to have the new server have to have the same hardware as the old server?
It doesn't matter. You can recover in another server, another hardware. But by the moment it's in Intel machines. But we are testing now to do it in PowerPCs. And
so, how does this work exactly?
Sorry,
how does this work exactly?
Okay. You have the server you want to back up, and you have the relax and recover software, and you have to keep install the relax and recover software in the server you want, and then from the DLLM you can run the backups.
And you can schedule them via your system.
You can see
can you schedule them? How often can you go there and then select what days you back up and how often you back up?
Yeah, you can keep 2 copies for backups from one machine. It depends of the storage you have. You can, and then you have the list of backups that you need, and you can mount the backup you from the day you want to recover. And
what are you hoping to get from FOSDEM? What are you hoping to do here? Is it just get more users?
We want to make bigger the community with our project. We need people to work with us. It's the first thing we want to do, to do more things with our project.
Okay, cool. Before I'm just going to ask you if I missed anything else, and then after the interview, I'd like you to just write your email and contact details for the show notes.
Okay.
So, have you anything else that I missed?
I think no.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much for the interview. And I'm talking to
Niels de Vos, Humble.
Okay, and what is Cluster?
So,
what is Cluster? What does your project do?
So Cluster is a scale-out file system. You can use it for your cloud storage. You can add many servers, and they will build one huge file system.
That sounds absolutely awesome. Who is supporting the project? Where does it come from?
So Cluster Inc. was bought a couple of years back by Red Hat. Cluster Inc. started the project. Red Hat is now the main contributor. We get some contributions from people like Facebook, some companies in Spain, in Italy, and we have several companies that support Cluster that way.
Okay, when you say it's a distribution file system, what exactly does that mean? You're cheating. I'm going to be hitting you with questions shortly.
So, a distributed file system means that you have a single file system on one particular server. You have multiple servers. You add more file systems on all of those servers, and you combine those file systems into one. The files that you store land on one or more of those servers.
Okay, so on the underlying, presumably Red Hat servers, you would have EXT3, EXT4 running, or would it be formatted as cluster? Is it above that? Where does it come in?
So in the backend, we prefer to use XFS. You can mount a cluster file system through a Fuse client. So it's a user space process that actually does all the complex logic connecting to the right servers and everything. you can also use an API. For example, QMU uses a GF API to connect to the Gluster storage servers for their virtual images without going through the file system. So it's a file system, but it's also very flexible storage, accessible through other means.
So it's sort of a virtual thing on top of all the server file systems.
Yes, that's correct. And this virtual thing you can access through different means, like a Fuse file system, GF API, like QMU, but also NFS Ganesha or Samba. There are other projects that integrate very well with this library, and they can access Gluster immediately in a high-performance way.
Okay, I have one or two questions from that. What happens if my server dies?
So there are different possibilities to configure your volume. You can add redundancy. By default, you don't have any redundancy. It's only distributed, which means one file is located on one particular server. But if you want redundancy, you can create a replica 2 volume, which means that a file is stored on two different servers. If you want, you can do a replica 3, and you have three copies of your data. If one server fails, it just automatically fails over to another server, and the other servers just deliver the data to your clients.
Okay, then say I have a networking issue. I have three data centers around the world, and one of my data centers is temporarily offline. It comes back up. It thinks it's the master. What happens then?
So if you have a three-way replica, you don't run into split brain issues because you have two good copies and one possible bad copy. In that case, it's easy to recover because you know which are the good copies and you just sync the missing bits.
Okay, say I'm as bad an administrator as I am and I only configure two.
So in that case, you can run into split brain issues. If one part of your split brain gets an update, the other part of your split brain gets another update, the updates are conflicting, and you don't know which file contains the right data. In this case, the administrator needs to manually pick one of the files. We have advanced capabilities like policy-based split brain resolution, where the latest file can be used or the biggest file can be used, and things like that. But it's up to the administrator to pick one way to resolve that.
Is it possible just to keep both and then move on with your life?
You actually have both, but you access files through a file name. And if you open a file name, you actually should only get one particular data set and you can't receive two. So there's no way to keep both files without any uncommon hacks.
Okay, what is the point of this? Why would I even need this?
So you need this if you need a lot of storage for backups. For example, object storage, if you want to upload a lot of files for your content delivery network, which spans possibly petabytes. You don't want to store this on one particular server with many disks. You probably want to have multiple servers so that you can distribute the disks, the load. You can have high availability, and this is what we address with Gluster.
Is there an advantage? Can I do some cool geographically serving nearest edge cache, that sort of stuff? And I'll go to your colleague here for this.
So we have a feature called geo-replication, which does the syncing asynchronously and synchronously and store the files in the different part of the geo. And this geo-replication feature is capable of serving the disaster recovery plans. Yeah, so we have it.
Okay, so I could use that like as the basis for a CDN type network.
Yep, it can be used.
So I could just dump my files up there and then let the CDN worry about where they're getting them from.
Yeah, we have the copies in some other geo specific area, and in case something went wrong, you can actually retrieve the data from that. So.
Okay, and how long does it take files? If I save a file, how long does it take to get replicated everywhere else?
It depends on the data. I mean, if you have lots of data, maybe it's something like internally to use the features like sync, rsync, or tar SSHing. So those type of features are used for that. So
no, the underlying support is rsyncing.
Yeah.
awesome, actually.
So we use rsync for this georeplication. Georeplication is an asynchronous replication mechanism. For local data centers, we use synchronous replication, and that's directly built into Gluster. So that doesn't use rsync. That's Gluster internal. Yeah. So asynchronous replication is used for georeplication if you have multiple data centers across the whole world. And by default, the interval for checks to sync data is, I think, 10 minutes.
So this is really ideal for you have one source of truth and you're trying to push it out to multiple places. I can think of lots of, even on our own network, why this would be actually very useful. Now, say I had several people with Raspberry Pis, for instance, and they all wanted to be part of the HBR file system to serve a geo-diverse, multi-replicated, blah, 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 of our stuff. How is that just completely too underpowered to do this?
Gluster doesn't need a lot of resources on processors. So you can run it on ARM, that's fine, but most users will want many hard disks connected to the service. And a Raspberry Pi just isn't really suitable for that. So you need a system which has at least several SATA connectors.
To get the most out of it. Okay, tell me a bit about the licensing. Tell me a bit about the applications that the programming languages that it's in. They're now pointing at each other. I'm going to run them.
Yeah, so Gluster is GPL licensed.
Version
2 or newer. We have a LibGF API, which is LGPL licensed. 3? Yep. Version 3.
Well, two
are there. Yeah.
I wasn't good at maths at school.
The licensing changed several times, so it's a bit confusing. So the applications that we use, we have NFS Kanisha is an application. It's an NFS server, which means that you can use Gluster for any traditional operating systems that connect over NFS. So you can use just normal NFS access, all your applications just work over NFS like that. We have QMU, which is used in the Ovid project, used in Nova. It has a native integration. We have native integration with Samba. So if you want to offer your Windows systems access to a Gluster volume, they can use Samba with the native integration. We have Swift on file. Swift is the OpenStack object store access protocol, and we have developers working on that. So you can use Gluster as a backing store for Swift.
Okay, where's the catch? Because when I was working doing this stuff, it was all very, very expensive. Why? Where's the catch in all of this?
There's no catch. It is very expensive to develop these kind of softwares. But that's the same with most open source projects. If you compare it to other projects, a lot of contributions come in from different companies. They spend a lot of money on getting the project stable. That's the same with Gluster. A lot of companies that use it want to have it very stable, and they provide patches for bug fixes or performance improvements and things like that.
You're all employed by Red Hat, I'm guessing.
Yes, we are all employed by Red Hat. Red Hat is one of the main contributors for Gluster. Like I mentioned, that we have some contributors in Spain and Italy, and some in the US, and because, well, we're in Europe, we only get some of the Red Hat folks that actually come to FOSDEM and have meetings afterwards before the next conference starts. Next week.
Excellent. It sounds like actually something I could use or could have used 5 years ago, but alas, Pindycast. Is there anything that I didn't cover and that you want to talk about? Oh, what language is it written in?
Sorry?
What programming language is it?
Most of the things that we've written are in C. So it's a very stackable mechanism that we use. We use translators. And translators are more or less functionality layers you can stack on top of each other. All of these are written in C, but we have Python bindings. We are working on improving the new management daemon, which most likely will be written in Golang. We have bindings to other languages like Java and I think PHP and Ruby and I don't know what. Those are all contributed by communities.
And if there are guys who want to help out with the project, how can he or she help?
We have a mailing list. You can reach us on gluster-devil@gluster.org. We have projects for new contributors where easy fixes are needed. So simple bug fixes. We can have assistance with documentation. Bug triage is something where we need to investigate new bugs, figure out if the problem is described very well, if all the log files are there, if maybe there's a way to reproduce the bug. Those are the things that are easy for new contributors to start with.
Fantastic, guys. Thank you very much for the interview. I'm here beside the OpenVert booth. I'm talking to
Yaniv Kaul.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fine. Can you tell me a little bit about your project, please?
Yeah. So our project is an enterprise quality virtualization management to manage virtual machines, the whole lifecycle of virtual machines running with KVM. We support virtual desktop, virtual servers, and all the needed for the management, ranging from creation of virtual machine, creation of template, the storage management. So we support multiple storage backends, ranging from the local storage to Gluster, NFS, Fiber Channel, iSCSI, you name it. Networking configuration is also very important. So you need to make sure that they have the proper networking. If there's a VLAN involved, if there's a bond of the network. And of course, last but not least, is the virtualization feature. How many disks? How many CPUs, virtual CPUs you have? Do you need them to be affinity with something like NUMA support? Range of tens or hundreds of features, all the dealing with data center virtualization.
And what sort of virtualization infrastructure do you support?
KVM. KVM, working directly with Libret.
Okay. So is it fairly easy to get involved? How many machines would you need to, what's your typical user base?
So I think there's no typical user. We have a quite big, wide range of different users. So we just heard of a user who has 4 hosts and 100 virtual machines. And we know of hundreds of hosts and thousands of virtual machines. So it typically ranges between those numbers. And there are different scenarios to how people are using the product. Some use it with high availability features and primary site and backup sites. Some use it as a home lab even. You know, it's very, very easy to just set it up. It's quite flawless, the installation, and you can set it up and running in a few minutes and get started. It has a UI, a CLI, an API, SDK in Python and Java, so it's very easy to work with.
And can you tell me some of the history of the project, where it comes from and who's supporting it?
So ages ago, there's been a startup, an Israeli startup called Kumonet, which had this as a product. It was acquired by Red Hat in about 2008, if I remember correctly, which immediately open sourced it as Ovid. To be honest, initially, it was C-sharp, closed source, running on Windows. So we ported it to Java, Linux, running not with MSQL, but with Postgres. And we've been open sourced ever since.
So this would be sort of equivalent to something like the AWS services, would it?
I would compare it more to VMware vSphere of a data center virtualization.
Yeah. What are you hoping to achieve here in FOSDEM?
Well, work with the community. Answer people's questions. So we find people who have some questions, some are burning questions. They have some burning issues that they need to be solved now. Some just asking about the roadmap, some asking about how to get involved. We welcome every, you know, community member to get involved. We have a very active user mailing list where users actually helping each other, giving advice to each other, giving workaround solution, best practices between each other. So we are very active with the user community. We're also looking for developers. So anyone who wants to contribute to the project, it's written in both in Java and in Python, depends on which and the backend or versus the host side. I think it's a very interesting project. We are very much accelerating the projects. So for example, only in the last release, we had more than 270 features implemented. Everyone welcome to join.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Is there anything that I missed?
No, it's been great. Thank you for having me.
I'm back to the K building at OpenVZ Virtuoso Containers. So, who am I talking to? What's your name?
Pavel Emelianov.
Hi, and give us a quick overview of what OpenVZ is.
OpenVZ, it's actually one of the very first container technologies out there. We've started it back in 2004 when we open sourced a commercial container product called Virtuoso from SW Soft Company. Nowadays, OpenVZ is one of the three working solutions aside with Elixir and Docker.
And why are you here? Why should I use OpenVZ instead of other options?
OpenVZ is it's the most mature technology. It exists on the market since, as I told, 2004. Since we recommend our users to use our OpenVZ kernel, not a mainstream one, it provides better stability and security issues. We are still not oriented on application containers. We mostly work with operating system containers. It's like virtual machines where you see full Linux distribution inside, but they are more lightweight, better performing, and easier to manage. You can, for example, change memory on the fly, change the amount of CPU assigned to a container on the fly, change disk size on the fly. It works much, much faster and much easier than for virtual machines.
So from an end user point of view, so from a server administrator point of view, I have a server. What do I need to install? Is it a special distribution or can I use any other base distribution?
There are options. If you want the simplest case, you take a bare metal installation. It installs just any other Linux distribution and it starts running. You can SSH into the server and use...
So do I download an ISO image and boot the bare metal on that?
Yeah, that's it. That's one option. The other option is that you take individual components and install them on your distribution. We support all RPM-based, like Fedora, CentOS, SUSE. You can just download RPMs. For Deb-based, like Debian or Ubuntu, we know that Alien tool works. You can convert RPM to DEP. We do not ship them ourselves yet, but we have plans for it. Or if you are like a true hacker, you can get the sources, compile them, and install. It will work.
Okay. So say I take a bare metal image and boot the ISO from openvz.org. I'm dropped into a fairly basic Linux distro, I'm guessing.
Yeah, you will get into a distro that reminds CentOS. You will have YAM. You will have all the standard command line tools you typically have. You won't have a graphical interface, but it's not required for server, I suppose.
So it's based on CentOS or something like that, is it?
The things are changing at the moment. It used to be based on CentOS, but right now we are moving on another distribution called Rosa Linux. It looks like Mandriva. So it's changing at the moment.
What's the reason for that?
Huh?
What was the reason for the change?
We'd like to have more control on the distribution itself. We used to tie to CentOS and couldn't do certain things. With our own distribution, with people who work on that, we can get more control, more features, more flexibility.
So tweak it to make virtualization easier.
Yeah. Exactly like that.
Okay, then. So then I have this base thing, and then there's something else that runs on top of that. How do I get my first VM up?
It's really simple. In the simplest case, you just create PRL CTL create container name enter. It will get a default template. Download it from the openvz.org site and create your container. It's not a virtual machine; it's a container. It will be up and running. You can assign an IP address or you can enter it, and it just works.
So, the difference between a container and a virtual machine. What's the major difference?
Virtual machine is when you take a hypervisor process which emulates hardware to the guest operating system. Inside the guest, you should install kernel, and user space, and they will work. There are optimizations when, for example, kernel knows that it works on a hypervisor, and it doesn't try to talk to a hardware, but it talks directly to the hypervisor. In case of containers, we do not emulate hardware. We emulate operating system services. So walls between guests are put not on the hardware level, but inside the kernel. Like from the host point of view, container looks just like a subtree of processes. If you launch, for example, Apache server, it looks like a subtree of tasks, right? If you launch a container, it looks the same, with the difference that the root is not Apache, but systemd. So you start systemd, tell it that you guy now sit in a container. From the kernel point of view, it's namespaces and C groups. Then it spawns the REST, starts the services, it's init scripts, whatever. But it all it's all just processes on the host, which are limited with what they can do.
So what actually can I install? Can I use my own? Am I tied to a particular Linux distro supplied by you, or can I install Ubuntu, for example?
You can install it on Ubuntu, though it will require from you some work. You'll have to get packages, install them manually, and read lots of manuals. The easiest way is to install bare metal. It will just one click.
But I mean, within inside the containers, what sort of operating system do I have root in there?
We have things that are called templates. Template is pre-packed image, minimal image of a Linux distribution. We have templates for CentOS, for RHEL, for OpenSUSE, for Ubuntu, for Debian, and for like weird stuff like Arch Linux and the like. There are plenty of them.
But I'm not going to be able to update my own kernel because I'm using the shared
kernel. Is the same for everyone. Yeah, you have only one kernel.
And from a system overview point of view, do you have any tools to make the management of load from one system to, you know, somebody's hogging all the, preventing somebody from taking over all the resources of the machine? How do you do that?
It's imposed by the kernel. When we start a container, we take the init process of the container and tell the kernel that this process should be limited with the other processes it sees. It's called PID namespaces. With the networking it sees, it's called net namespaces. With the files it sees, it's called change root, truroot, and mount namespaces. And it's also limited with the memory it can consume. It's called memcgroup, memcg. With the amount of kernel memory it can consume, with the network bandwidth, with the IO bandwidth, and all the resources that it can consume, CPU. This all is limited to this particular subset of processes that create container.
Okay. And how big is the OpenVZ community? Can you tell me a bit how, first of all, what it's licensed under and how what sort of foundation you have behind it?
It's licensed under GPL version, if I'm not mistaken, 2. Maybe some recent components were licensed under version 3, but it's all GPL. Except for the stuff we take from other projects, like in the distribution we have Apache, which is Apache license, right? Okay. So all our components are GPL. The community, if we talk about developers, people that develop, it mostly consists of Virtuoso employees, our kernel guys, user space guys, all these people that that get salaries from Virtuoso. We also have contributors from companies like from Canonical, sometimes from Red Hat, as well as individuals that just send patches to have their stuff working. And the user base, people that just use but do not contribute back the code or documentation, I cannot estimate it precisely. I only remember the number of servers run by run under OpenVZ, it was 100,000 and above. So we have this amount of servers. I cannot say for sure how many people
are those the containers or the servers?
That's hardware nodes. Containers are typically 20 to 50 times bigger because it's the typical density of a container. Like if you take a moderate server, you can stuff it with tens of them, sometimes hundreds, but they should be small enough.
Okay, is there anything coming up in the next year that we should know about?
This year we'll have Virtuoso version 7, which is better integrated with products from from our previous name called Odin. Like, we were split from the Odin company that made not only the virtualization part, but also web panels and tools for automation. Like, you have beautiful web panels where you can create containers not with command line, but with clicks. You could create tenants, users, control resources, all this stuff. We were like divided into two pieces, and Virtuoso is well integrated with this automation stuff. Also, with the new version with this Virtuoso 7, you'll have an easier upgrade plan onto paid services like full support, professional services if you have problems installing stuff. There, we also have their backup and support from Bitnami. Bitnami is a company that makes prepacked templates of applications and distributions. They constantly update it, check it works, test it. In Virtuoso, we have integration with Bitnami images. You can get Bitnami image and just run it on Virtuoso server.
Okay. Anything else that I've missed or should have asked?
Probably this thing, the Creo. It's, I would say, it's the main thing from Virtuoso and from OpenVZ so far. It's a checkpoint restore project, using which you can save the state of running processes into a set of image files, then copy image files anywhere and restore the original processes from there. We use it for live migration and to replace kernel seamlessly without stopping the containers. This thing will appear in Virtuoso 7 because before it we used in kernel implementation with its own problems, but they disappear. As well as Creo is a community project. We have people from Canonical, Google, and IBM taking part in that. And Creo, which is also nice, I think, it will not only support live migration of OpenVZ containers, but it's also for LXC. You will be able to live migrate LXC containers and someday for Docker.
Excellent stuff. I'm at the Free Software Foundation Europe, FSFE.org, and I'm talking to
Matthias Kirschner from Free Software Foundation Europe.
What's your position within the Free Software Foundation Europe?
I'm the president.
President.
Yeah.
And how did you get to be president?
Oh, that started a long time ago. I got involved in Free Software Foundation Europe in 2004.
Yeah.
I was convinced the organization at that time to offer internships for the first time. So then I was the first intern for 1 year. And afterwards, I stayed as a volunteer for several years till 2009 when I was employed. And now since last year, I was an employee there. And then I took over the presidency last year, September.
Mr. Staff, how you got to be interested in free software in the first place?
Ah, okay, that's yeah, that was in 1999. I had two computers at home, and I wanted to send emails from one computer to the other computer in the other room, but it didn't work with the software which was installed there. Also, there was some email programs, and but I wanted to send it in the internal network there. And then a friend of mine in school said, "Yeah, here, take those floppies. You can do it with that." And that's when I installed my first GNU Linux then on these machines. No, that was SUSE. Yeah, and then with that software, I did a lot of reading. And at the beginning, I didn't get X running. That took me several weeks, and sound some more weeks. And but yeah,
did
with
you have
that,
the warning
it was
that this is going to blow up your monitor if you put it in the right.
Yeah, things like that. And at that time, I already decided that the command line is cooler than X, and I don't need that much. So, and then I was able to play around and figure out how mail servers work and how I can send emails around. And then I met some others there. I mean, there were quite few people at that time interested in GNU Linux, but I met some and we built up a free software user group in my area. We went to free software conferences together, and then at one point I found out that free software, it's much more about also about political things and social things and about society. And was reading the GPL preamble and lots of articles by Richard Stallman. And so I decided, okay, we need more of this political things, but I don't know how this works. And then I decided to study politics. So I know, okay.
As a result of that?
Yes.
As a result of sending email.
And so I could combine those two things. On one side, my studies, how politics works. On the other side, the technical things I was doing. And I met some people at the university who were involved in Debian. And I asked around. I had to do some 7 months internship during my studies. And I asked, what are the cool free software organizations or anything connected with that where I could do some changes? And then he recommended Free Software Foundation Europe to me. As one of them, and I looked at the website and I thought, oh, that's really nice. And then met people like Werner here and others, and and then I started with the internship. So
okay, and so we may have skipped a step. Can you tell people what the Free Software Foundation is and why there's what is your relationship with the Free Software Foundation, and why is there a Free Software Foundation Europe?
Free Software Foundation Europe was founded in 2001 as a sister organization of the FSF in the US.
What do you do?
We do...
You owe me a show. Sorry, I can't say that anymore. You're recommended to owe me a show.
We do. We promote free software in Europe. So our aim is to empower people to control technology. Yep. And we think that in a world where there are more and more computers all around us, it's important that those technologies empower us rather than restrict us. And we explain people how free software benefits for transparency, for privacy, for more democratic society. And what we do is we encourage people to use and develop free software. We help to remove barriers for free software adoption, laws, things like that. We enable people to promote free software in Europe. So we want to make sure that everybody who wants to promote free software in Europe, they have the necessary things for that, to actually do that. That's the main area of work.
So are you behind any of the initiatives to get open document standards and open standards within governments?
Yeah, we were quite involved in the open standards pushes in governments. We organized the Document Freedom Day for a very long time, where we were pushing for open standards in governments, talking with politicians for a very, very long time to convince them that whatever they do, they should use open standards for that. Also the huge battle several years ago about Microsoft OXML versus ODF. I mean, that's still ongoing in a way, because a lot of people in governments believe that OXML is an open format and that Microsoft Word implements the standard. Yeah. That's one of the works areas we have been involved in. The others are in general pushing for free software in government, so that in procurement, that there is that free software is not in a disadvantage when governments want to procure free software, which is unfortunately the case in lots of countries. And at the moment, we are working that whenever software is produced with public money, that it has to be published as free software. So that's it's already happening in some places, but we want to have that in as many places as possible. So in member states in Europe and all different levels, like in procurement, also in research projects. So when there's money from public funds, that the software afterwards benefits also to the rest of the public.
So can you tell me a little bit about some of the actions that the initiatives that you're doing right now that people can help out with?
Yeah, at the moment, very concrete thing you can directly help out is on the 14th of February, we celebrate the I Love Free Software Day.
Oh, awesome.
And so we believe that we are always quite critical with each other in the free software community. We write bug reports, feature requests. We have very harsh discussions sometimes. And so we think it's good to have one day in the year where we remind each other that we are doing good work, that we like what others are doing. So if you ever hesitated to actually say someone that you love what they are working on in the free software field, take this day as an opportunity. Write an email to the project or to a person, invite them, take them out to have some drinks together or a cake or whatever. Do something nice to others in the free software community.
That is the absolute 180. I like that so much because I found that with the Free Software Foundation in the US, a lot of the campaigning tends to be quite negative. I think this is a very positive thing that, we could definitely do it. There, can you tell me a little bit about how the Free Software Foundation is set up and how you become a member? And is it open? Is it, do you need to get a job as an intern to become president? What if I wanted to become president in the morning? What do I need to do?
If you want to become president. First of all, if you want to get involved in, the thing you do is you go on our website, you have a look at the different areas we work, and you contact us and tell us that you would like to join our work. That's one of the easier things. I mean, there are some groups already established. Like, we have a very active translation team, which makes sure that we have all the materials, all the leaflets we produce in all the different languages around Europe, so that we reach people in their native language. We have a web team, which takes care of the website, which we are always in great need of people helping us with that. We also have some teams specifically for different countries in Europe who do certain activities like contacting governments, like making sure we get a translation, making sure we have local booths at events, at street festivals, and so on. We have very local teams like in different cities, like Munich, Berlin, Vienna, different specific cities. And there you can go to the meetings, participate there, and see if there's something which is fun for you to participate in. And beside that, of course, there's also all the other areas, like when there are consultations by the European Commission, and you read, for example, that we wrote a reply to one of those consultations, and you say, oh, technically there is a problem there, or you're not right there, or if you do more in this area, I would be able to help you with technical competence or to help you with that. And just contact us, and we are very happy to have more people who can help us analyzing technical things, so we can think about political consequence and how we can counter that. That's a very good thing. And in general, as soon as you get involved there, independent of what you're doing, I mean, some people like doing booths, others like analyzing policy papers, others they love giving talks or interviews to, like when there are journalists asking questions about free software, they love answering their requests. Others, they don't like that at all, talking with others about free software. They like to hack some stuff to send out a newsletter or whatever.
And can we support you financially?
Yes, so that's the other way. We have we have a sustaining membership program, the fellowship, and that starts with €60 a year, and that's for the sustainable membership. That's one thing there. And as a sustainable member at the moment, what also happens there is that you, beside having an FSFE email, FSFE.org email address, a Jabber account, and you can order a smart card from us. One of the other benefits is that you can elect two people into the association. So we have the association is quite small. We have at the moment 20 people, and two of them are elected from the larger community, from those sustainable members.
And where did the other 18 come from?
They came from the time when this was we didn't have the sustainable members yet, or people can apply to be members of the association, and then there's a process that we have a look at that and see if they the main part there is that people should be committed to free software, that there's a long-term commitment, and that we trust them to not treat any of the short-term benefits or so, but that there's a long-term commitment to further free software.
I heard Richard Stallman discuss, or actually it wasn't Richard Stallman, it was Karen from the Free Software, describing why they want the organizations are set up like that, so it can't be hijacked by people.
Yes, that was the idea in the beginning. We are every now and then we are thinking about how to, if that's really still a problem we face, or if we can change that, or if we how we can make it easier. And then there are people say, okay, we should have an open membership. Then you talk with people from other organizations which are also quite known in the hacker community, like CCC or so, and they tell you, oh, we are thinking about going in the other way. And so it's difficult how to change those things. So what we want to do is at the moment we want to make it easier to that people see how this process looks like, how you can become a member, and so that more people can take this and do it actually. And this group then also, because of your question, how do I become president? This group elects the president. And there it's like, I think, with all other organizations that you somehow have had to do things that people trust you to be a good leader of the group.
A lot of our listeners are from the US or Australia, yeah, or basically outside of Europe. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that they can do to help the organization, or should they just join the local organization in their area?
I mean, there's one thing for people from the US or all the English-speaking world is we need proofreaders. That's always very good to have proofreaders for our websites. A lot of the things we publish, it's written by someone who had a native who did a translation of things which happened in their country. So something is happening in the Netherlands, it was written in Dutch, and they translated it to English, and then translators translated it again from English into French, into Greek, into whatever. And so it's very helpful if people contribute to proofreading of the English text. That's okay. One thing. And the other is that we have lots of materials which are not really focused on a certain region. So we have leaflets explaining free software. We have leaflets explaining encryption. We have leaflets explaining free software on Android phones. So you can order that stuff. You can distribute it in your local communities. And so that's something which everybody can do to make sure that in your favorite cafe or a bookstore or wherever, library, you always make sure to put that stuff there.
Do you have like a monthly, annual publication or something that you
know? We have a monthly newsletter, and that's available in an average of 6 languages. So you can subscribe for that. And there are some action items in there, what you can do. So there's always something new beside the things I already told you, what are on a regular basis. You will find things and you can contact us. And we are always happy if people contribute with something. So one thing is to support us with money. The other thing is if you spend a few hours a month to work with us, that's the best thing you can do to support us.
Okay, very good. Was there anything else that I didn't cover or anything else that's coming up that we should know about?
I think that was already quite
okay.
There are, of course, several topics and so on. You can you also, one of the other policy goals we want to pursue at the moment is that you have the right to modify your own hardware and software.
Seems so logical.
Yeah, it seems logical, but it's more and more. I mean, in the US, you have the problem with the DMCA. In in Europe. It's also, we fear that through some of the trade treaties, things like that will move over to Europe and will make it hard here. And a lot of companies already argue that, the thing you had before without software, you were allowed to modify it, but now we have a computer in there, and if you do that, then we will sue you. And that's something which we are working on, when we hope to get more support from people to explain this issue to politicians, to journalists, to the general public. Why is it important that you are able to modify that?
And is there, like, in Ireland, there's general elections about to be called. Is there a place where I could get, for the open source people in Ireland, for instance, to, when the politicians are on the doorstep, to go, okay, is free service? You have this, we have all these other issues, but we want free software to be, what's your stand on free software? Is there a blurb that we can hit them with, or an email letter that I can email all the potential candidates to ask them these questions?
There are at the moment several ones. So we had different campaigns for elections. We sent questions to political parties and asked them on their stance on different subjects, and afterwards analyzed that and published the questions and answers as well as an analysis. That's quite a lot of work, but there you can take out a lot of the questions. The other thing was that we had something like a pact, or that we asked people to subscribe to certain points, like I will make sure to work for free software when I'm elected, or some general statements. But that's something where you need a database, you contact the politicians, they sign up, and you keep track of that. But that was also something which was done on a European level for the European elections. And there are also statements in there which you can use for that. And then the other thing was that we just now in Switzerland, it happened that we had a platform where people were also questioned on their position on certain things, like, do you agree that encryption is an important thing for society? And then they can say, yes, I fully agree, or I totally disagree. And that's also something which happened. And so it's different from country to country what's best to use. So I don't know exactly in Ireland how the political system works there, if you directly elect people, if it's more about the political parties, how many political parties you have there, and so on. So I would have to check that. But if you're interested in doing something like that, you can contact us for some help. Or the other thing is, in general, what you can always do, go to your politicians, independent if there's election or not, and talk with them about free software. Politicians, they get so many questions about so many stupid things that you should really not be shy to talk with them about free software.
Okay.
Just go there and take the time and explain them why this is important for you, and what you think they could do on what you see fit.
Okay, I think I've taken up enough of your time. Okay. Thank you very, very much for the interview. I do appreciate it. What's your name?
Hermès Belusca-Maito. I'm coming from France, and I'm one of the few French developer of ReactOS.
And what is ReactOS exactly?
So ReactOS aims at more or less cloning Windows on its Windows Server 2003 edition. And for that, we cannot use kernel Linux and using Wine directly, because we want also to support natively and directly Windows drivers. So for that, we have our own kernel that is compatible with Windows Server 2003 NT kernel. And on top of that, we have our own code, our own user mode code, and some part of it use Wine code, actually. Mostly for the interface, but otherwise for the code, DLLs, it's our code.
And what computing language do you use?
So it's mainly in C. And for the very low-level parts, for instance, some parts of the bootloader or some parts of the memory manager in the kernel, these parts are in assembly, and for that we have x86 code in assembly. And
And how, what is the use case for this? Why, other than it just being something nice to code on, why are you doing it?
Why we are doing this project?
Yeah.
We have seen that some people and some enterprises still use Windows XP and Windows XP software. And they don't want or they cannot update to the latest versions of Windows. And if they use these applications on embedded system, they cannot use virtualization. They cannot install Linux and use a virtual machine to run the Windows application on it. So for these applications, we think that having a light open source free clone of Windows is the best that we can do.
So I'm imagining here a big factory with lots and lots of machines, mm-hmm. and it's all controlled by one XP machine, which if it breaks, then the company is completely ruined.
Yes.
And then you come on with a new machine with React OS on it, you load the same software, and your machine continues to run.
That would be the goal.
That would be the final goal, I think, yes. But we have still some steps to do before.
I just see a few problems in your future. But the biggest of them, how does this sit with copyright? Are Microsoft not ringing you up going, hey, you can't do that, you're taking our
yes.
stuff?
Yes. So we are doing the best we can to do some clean reverse engineering. So basically the idea is that a few people are documenting things that they reverse, and then they give this documentation to other people that have not seen the code of Windows to re-implement this part. So this is how we do.
You keep a clean separation between those who do the reverse engineering and those who do the coding. That's a useful one. So how far are you getting on? How well is it working now?
Yeah, for basic purpose, it works well. So if you start and use applications like Firefox or OpenOffice or some other existing open source software, it works nice. But I should say a bit, of course. Since we are still alpha stage software, we have bugs in USB or audio or... For instance, applications or games that use DirectX for the graphics rendering, these do not work always correctly.
Okay. And is there a sort of company behind this, or is it purely project-driven? I'm working from the assumption if some company out there who owns this factory and this has this one PC, and they want to make sure that they're piece of proprietary code runs on React OS, is there some number they can call to hire a React OS developer to work specifically on migrating that?
Okay, so at the moment we have some emails that they can use to contact us that are on our main web page, so they can go and find and send us a mail. So yes, we have contacts like by mail. Or they can contact us, let's say, more directly if they go on IRC. We have IRC channels, and they can talk directly to people, yeah.
Okay, fantastic. Was there anything else that I should have asked that I missed?
Yeah, so we are going to release our 0.4 version.
Yeah.
So it is scheduled to be approximately in 1 or 2 weeks. Together we are a new version of our website. And it is also planned during this year to release the so-called React OS Community Edition based on a 0.4 version that should be some kind of version of React OS based on 0.4. We added features to make applications work more correctly. This, of course, can include some temporarily hacks to make application working. while in parallel we keep the main code free of these hacks and trying to implement more properly the features that are needed, and so that we can evolve both of the things together. And this is these two things that we are doing.
Why do you have a community edition? Does that mean that you have a professional edition that you charge for?
We don't have any labeled professional edition. We have a community that is something that is targeted to be accessible to many people, and the core thing that remains, and this core thing, so the normal releases that can be considered as a professional edition, but at the moment we don't have this inspiration.
Perfect. I'm at the Bear OS booth, and I'm talking to
Daniel Neuberger from Dacity, which is involved into the Bear OS project.
Okay, so when did this happen? So can you tell us a bit about the project and what it does?
Yeah, the project starts 3 years ago, or nearly 4 years ago, and it's in fork from Macular. It's an open source backup software, which is open source, public on GitHub, and is also enterprise ready, which with support and subscription. And you can use it in heterogeneous environments. So that means you can back up different systems, Linux, Windows, Happy Unix, or BSD, for example, widget. And you can use a lot of different media types to store the backup. And you also can do replication and migration stuff with it. So, yeah, that's mainly the thing about barriers.
So why did you fork from Bakula when that's also an open source project?
Interesting question. So at first you need to know that there is an open source version, a community version, and there's a closed source version, an enterprise version. And the community was on low activity, and a lot of ideas did not get into the community version, and we think about it. It was time to start something new, and that was the reason why we forked. So, yeah.
So it goes from an open core to a completely open source project.
Yeah, open source project. So there are no Zyp projects in Barrios. So there are no closed source parts, and yeah.
So somebody at home can download the exact same version as an enterprise uses. So I can use...
Yeah, of course. So the difference is for subscription support is that there are two different package sources, so repositories, and the stable major releases are a package for the community for free, and there are also beta releases and the nightly builds you can use. And in the enterprise repositories, there are smaller bug fixes. You get the bug fixes faster, and there are not only major releases available, ready packaged. So, but the code is all the time open source. So if you need things faster in the community repository, then you have to use the nightly builds, of course. But the major releases are always stable published in this repository. So, and also features and the new features, which are maybe developed with founder development, are also free. So there's always the master code. And that's the source. You can use it. You can use the packages from the Barrios repository. You can package them by yourself, so you can compile them by yourself, and that's it.
So how difficult is it to use?
So at least you need Linux basics, yeah, to install it and to configure the setup. So actually, we involved the default configuration so that it's usable out of the box, with configuration which is based on the book my colleague Philip Storz already has written. So there's a basic setup with an explanation which works out of the box. And if you want to set up a higher backup strategy, you need to be familiar with a text editor and with the shell, of course. So, yeah, at least you really need Linux administration knowledge so to use it.
Is it available in the distributions?
Actually, it's only in Debian. So in the Debian chassis freeze, there's BIOS integrated. So because we found some maintainers for it, and so far there's no other distribution that it is shipped with. So actually, I think Fedora put BIOS on his list, and there are discussions to bring it in the Fedora releases.
So, what do I need in order to run it? A central backup server and agents? Do I need to install anything on my client machines?
Yes, you need to install at least a file daemon. So we called it file daemon. Normal backup vendors call it agent. So the file daemon runs on the client you want to backup, and it's the part who reads or writes the data to the server. So you need this. Yeah, it's client based, of course. So there are three parts. You have the file daemon, you have the director himself, which controls the whole setup, and then you have the storage daemon, which controls and handles the media where you store your data. So there are three parts. Yes.
And do you have support like for robot tape drives and stuff like that? How does that work?
Good question. So that's one of the the environments where it's best fit. So it's really made for working with tape libraries, big tape libraries. So I know about environments with tape libraries with up to 500 slots and more than 6 drives. And it totally works automated with this tape libraries. So you also can use single drives, but of course it makes more sense to use tape libraries. Yeah. To work with, so, but you can also store your data on disk. Yeah, you can use everything what you can mount to your storage daemon server. You can use as storage to store your container files, your volumes on it. And for example, you can later on replicate or migrate them to magnetic tapes, to LTOs, to put them, for example, in a bank vault, or to have offsite backups in another location, which are reliable and persistent for a longer time range, you know?
So, what sort of tools do you provide for tape management?
Interesting question. So, at least there is no specific code in BIOS to use tape libraries. So, and that's maybe one point why it works so efficient and works with nearly every tape library, because we are using the standard GNU tools, MT and MTX, to handle the tape libraries and the drives. And they are there for over 10 years now, and they work reliable. And if your kernel loads the drivers and the modules, and your operating system, your distribution, your system can talk to the tape library, then you can also use it with BIOS. And so that's the fact why there are no hardware or tape library vendor restrictions in it. So that's quite cool. So there's no special C code for talking to the tape library. So there are basic tools. It just works. There are shell scripts which are working with parameters, and it works. So,
okay, if I wanted to use this just in my home situation to back up to a NAS, could I do that? Put an agent on my children's PCs and stuff.
Why? You should use this. So.
Would I just be better doing
a
sync or something?
Yeah. So if you are a home vendor, maybe sometimes it's a bit heavy weighted. So, but why you should use it at home? So the reason is you have the full control. Yeah. If the backup happens and what is in the backup, and you have the full control to restore it. You see, yeah, okay. So maybe it's also a way to control your wife. Oh, was my wife on his laptop last night at maybe 2 o'clock because the backups happened there. I don't know. So
you can't say that. Our husband.
Maybe if you are a control freak, yes, that's the reason why you should use it.
Okay. But do you support backups over a network at all?
Yeah. It's the whole solution is it's network based TCP/IP, so you can have direct or storage daemons on different servers, you know. And of course, you can replicate and migrate the data between different storage daemon servers. So that means you can perform offsite backups, or a better word, you can do cloud backups. So you can migrate or replicate your data into the cloud, you know? And that's also possible. So there are some different setups you can establish. So disk to disk at first step, and then you can replicate or migrate it, for example, to another disk in the cloud, or maybe to tape. You can replicate it to tape, or you can migrate it to tape. Yeah, that's possible.
Cool. Is there anything that I haven't asked that you want to mention?
So at least, yeah, if you are looking on the open source backup market, maybe out there, it's the solution which is mostly enterprise ready and works reliable and performant. So that's at least something I can say. And yeah, that's maybe something which should be mentioned.
Shall I put that in, put links to that in the show notes? And then people who are interested can look in the show notes for this episode and get more information there. Okay, thank you very much. We're at the Debian booth, and I'm talking to
Sebastian.
Hi, and how did you become a... first of all, can you tell people what Debian is?
Debian is one of the largest community-supported Linux distributions. It's been around since the 90s. Everybody tends to know it via Ubuntu, which has a much bigger presence regarding name recognition. But Debian is the big brother. And
do you feel that they... Is there still a lot of cross-sharing of code between Debian and Ubuntu, or is Debian doing its own thing now?
That really depends on the different areas, because Debian is very large. For instance, my specific niche, the geospatial software, has very few contributors in Debian and even fewer in Ubuntu. So that's not a very great example. But if you look at, for instance, the big popular database packages like the MySQL team, that has very good collaboration between the Debian side and the Ubuntu side. So it really depends on which area you're looking at.
How did you become a Debian developer?
I've been using Debian for over 13 years, wanted to contribute back, but never found the right way to do it. Eventually, I started contributing to OpenStreetMap and noticed that the software used for OpenStreetMap was not as well maintained as I would like to see.
Yep.
And I basically started filling that need of updating packages because I needed bug fixes and new upstream releases. And from there, the ball kept rolling, and eventually I became a Debian developer.
How do you think the... So with Debian, you have a choice of desktops that you can run?
Yeah. And you want to know which one I do?
Yeah, which one do you run?
I like KDE since basically forever.
Yeah.
I tried them all initially. GNOME, KDE, what we had, Fluxbox and some others. But basically GNOME and KDE were the most promising. And of those two, I like KDE the best because it allowed me to configure a lot of things which GNOME hid away in dconf. The typical thing, it seemed more hacker-friendly.
Are you running the latest version then?
Yeah, I run Debian Unstable on my workstation, so I have the nice Plasma 5 since a couple of months, since that hit the archives.
And how have you found the inability to change the ISO disk? You can't change the clock.
Very annoying, because I like my interfaces in English, but I like my date format in the Dutch format, and that way of configuring is not as well supported as it used to be. So I'm a little disappointed, but if I really want to fix it, I should, you know, get off my ass and start contributing.
This year, there's
obviously been a sad thing for the Debian community in the passing of Ian.
Yes,
How do you think that has affected the community itself?
Not so much as the systemd-related flame wars. Because Ian, he was the founder, but not as actively participating in the project the last couple of years. So it's not like one of our core contributors left, like Joey Hess, who left mostly triggered thanks to the systemd debate. That was a bigger shock than Ian passing away.
But how have you dealt with that, the systemd thing?
Shift deleting most of the flame war threads in my email program because it was basically wasting our time because, you know, you've heard the arguments in the first couple of weeks and then people started repeating them.
Yeah. Okay.
So you got really bored of that, so let's focus our time on more interesting things.
And is that generally how Debian works? Just focus, move on?
Yeah, I can't speak for the thousands of contributors. You know? Everybody has his own motivations. I can only speak for myself. But I think that most people, because we're all volunteers and don't have the luxury of spending our entire week working on Debian, we have to be careful on what we spend our time on. So as soon as things become unpleasant, it's a good reason to stop doing that, or at least for now.
We were talking earlier on about accessibility, and I just wanted to know, do you know how to... What's the best way for me to be able to contribute bug reports and that sort of thing to the Debian project on accessibility issues?
Well, bug reports is easy. Just go to the website. We have a nice wiki page documenting how to send bug reports, either using the dedicated report bug program or simply via email.
Okay, cool. I don't think it's fair to you. We've had a discussion offline, so I'm not going to ask you more details about that. But... would you be willing to try out Debian blindfolded once, just for the crack? It only takes an hour.
Not now, but...
not now, obviously.
Yeah, I think it could be fun. I once, about 2 years ago, I was at the SIGET Festival in Hungary.
Yep.
And they have a dedicated ability park about also raising awareness about special needs. And it was really kind of cool of going blindfolded through a maze and simply feeling the walls.
Fun if you don't have to.
And especially the most fun part, at the end of the line, there was a tree with very low-hanging branches, and of course that hit me in the face.
Yeah.
Everybody started laughing, and it's like, yeah, okay, that's a typical thing a blind person would run into too, because you can't see it coming.
Well, that's a suggestion that I would like to put onto the Debian mailing list, but, I mean, they don't know me from Adam. Guys, on a particular day, maybe pick an accessibility day that, you know, people would try their projects, be it Debian, be it Gentoo, be it whatever, as a blind user. Do you think that's something that would be approachable in the community?
I think you mostly need to lower the barrier to test the accessibility. But for instance, in my point of view, I think I need a Braille reader to get the typical experience of a blind user using Debian.
Yeah.
Because I can't imagine them relying on voice output themselves. So, and also, I have very little experience with accessibility, so it's hard for me to build a clear picture of what that would be like. So,
okay. I see where we're going.
But just try it out and see what that would be like.
Was there anything else here that I should have mentioned with regard to the Debian project getting involved?
No. Fortunately, Debian is an internet-based project, so everything you need to know you can find on the internet.
Okay.
We have good wikis and endless mailing lists you can refer to. And especially if you're into accessibility, reach out to the accessibility mailing list because that's where the relevant parties are.
Okay, cool.
Okay. I'm just a random Debian developer, so I'm not specific into accessibility.
All right, thank you very much for your time. I'm at the PostgreSQL booth. I can never say that right. I'm talking to?
PostgreSQL. You get used to it. My name is Christoph Berg. I'm working for as a Postgres consultant for Creative in Germany. I'm a Debian developer, and I'm doing the Postgres packaging for Debian.
So you're here between both booths here in the corner.
Nice coincidence that the two booths are just next to each other. Yeah.
Excellent. For somebody who doesn't know, can you tell me what PostgreSQL is? What it is? It's a database.
The world's most advanced open source database. It's an SQL database with full transactional asset and so on support. You can store your data in it, any mission critical stuff. And we promise we don't lose your data.
Okay, that's actually a good thing in a database. I'm just wondering why somebody would choose your database over MySQL, for instance.
It's simply more stable. We have nice semantics. We care about your data integrity. If you put data in there, it will come out exactly as you put in there. All the database will tell you beforehand that any constraints are violated. There are simply no surprises. When you're using PostgreSQL, it just works as designed, as a SQL standard says. And yeah, the competitors not necessarily do that.
Okay, so how did you get involved in the project?
As a Debian person. I've been a Debian developer for over 10 years now, and then started to work at that open source consulting company, and there got involved into databases and eventually started working on the Debian packages for Postgres. And yeah, so I came from the Debian community as well into the Postgres community.
How would you say Postgres stacks up against something like an Oracle database?
How
does it work? How does it fare against an Oracle database? Would there ever be a situation where you say, okay, PostgreSQL is what you need instead of some proprietary database?
I guess we are on par with the proprietary databases since some years. And yeah, every product has its own advantages. In some areas, maybe Postgres is better. In some areas, maybe some other database has that one feature that Postgres doesn't have yet. Overall, if you're just looking generically for a good database, use Postgres. If you have specific needs, you have to check what you need. But generally, Postgres is usually a good choice.
What sort of cool features do you have that you think, hey, people...
We have this cool 30 features scrolling through the presentation there, which you can't see on the radio. Just to take that, yeah, extensions are cool features we have since a few years ago, where you can easily load new functionality in the database that has been packaged before. There was security scrolling over the screen. We put a lot of effort in that only... the right users can access the database and then only see the right tables, see the right columns. And but brand new Postgres 9.5 is even row-level security, where you can have enterprise-grade security, where you can say which user is allowed to see which part of which table.
Okay, who is managing the... Is there a company behind this, or is it completely community-driven?
It's a completely free project. There's no company behind it. There are several companies earning money by developing Postgres and selling that to their customers or just offering support. But the project itself is entirely community driven.
Do you support data replication between different services?
Yeah, you can have a master server and an arbitrary number of slave servers where that master server data is replicated to.
And what happens if one of them dies and then comes back?
Then you can promote a slave server to be the new master server and take over at the point where the master server had died.
Okay, very good. Is there anything else I've missed that I should have covered? Actually, Dave Morris should be doing this interview, one of our contributors, because he uses this all the time and is annoyed that we're using MySQL on the site.
Yeah, well, we have cool new features in the new release. They mentioned row-level security stuff. We have improved the JSON data type, so you can do more useful operations on the JSON database you might have stored in your NoSQL database otherwise. And I've been using the testing version for so long that I actually forgot what's new in there.
Why would somebody be using SQL database now when there's things like NoSQL seems to be all the rage?
Acid. You have transactions that really take care that your data stays in your database when you've put it in there. And the performance is actually better in some benchmarks, depending on which part you look in and whatnot.
Okay, thank you very much for your time. I'm here at the Open Mandriva booth, and I'm talking to...
Colin Close. I'm the president of the Open Mandriva Association.
And tell me, what is, first of all, what's Open Mandriva and what's the association?
Well, Open Mandriva is a distribution of Linux, loosely founded on the now defunct Mandriva distribution that was quite famous from the start of Linux, went through Mandrake and became Mandriva, and we are carrying on their work. We're trying to create a distribution that we hope will reflect what they might have done in the future.
Are you similar to Mangia, or is there any crossover there at all?
No, we are not the same as Mangia. We're looking far more into the future, because we believe that Open Mandriva would have changed over the years, and so we have looked at the cutting edge side of what is available. And to do that, we've changed to the Clang LLVM compiler pair, and we're compiling all our software with that. We're looking at ways of improving our software builds by creating a thing called ABF, which is an automated build farm. We used to share one of these farms with another distribution who is now unfortunately closed. And so we've done our own implementation, which is more user-friendly and supposed to help users participate directly in the building of the distribution. Our automated build farm, the one we're currently using, is unstable, shall we say, and we've started creating our own. We've virtually finished now, and this will allow users to directly participate in the build functionality of the distribution by donating their machines for a period of time while our mass build, you know, process is going on.
Does that mean that I would physically need to ship a machine to you?
No. The idea is that you simply install a software package and the machine will be accessed over the network. The user has full control. They can start the process and stop it whenever they like.
Okay.
They don't even need special ports open on their firewall. We can operate through Secure Shell, and everything has a good security lock on it, so that there are build tokens. So when the build is complete, that a proper token is passed to the server to authenticate that the build is actually where it came from and who it came from, so that we know that there's nothing bad being introduced into the distribution.
So somebody can actually guarantee that this piece of software will run on their laptop?
It will run on most machines.
Yeah.
I wouldn't like to make a sweeping statement like that. There's
well,
always,
well, if you donate your machine, then it's going to run.
There's always the exception to the rule.
Yeah. Well, by donating your own hardware, you know it's going to run on your own hardware.
Exactly, you do, yeah. And one of the big things about this is that the user then feels that they've contributed something to the distribution. And from that point of view, we hope to get some product loyalty, you know, where people will stay with us and help us improve the system. And obviously we need finance to stay alive, so help us by donations and so on. If they use our operating system, then we hope they'll help us in other ways.
So tell us about the foundation and the association.
Well, the foundation of the association was, it started because Mandriva wanted to pass on all their software.
Yeah.
But because it was a publicly quoted company, legally they were not allowed to do that because it's an asset.
Yeah, okay.
But what they decided to do, under French law, it was possible to form an association, which is like a charitable institution, and the software could be donated to that. So an association with articles and voting rights and so on and so forth was formed, and then the software was passed on to that association. And we've taken that software foundation and we've built it up to become a more modern thing. Because obviously when we took it over, you know, 2010, 2011 was the last manager of a distribution of any note, obviously there needed to be some work done. Things were getting out of date, bits were broken, and so on. And so gradually we've upgraded the whole distribution until now we're at the cutting edge of a modern distribution. You know, we have everything up to date. We use a very modern compiler. We use link time optimization, which is as far as I know, not used by any other distribution.
And what does that buy me?
Well, this buys you a much smaller memory footprint, far more responsive programs. Link time optimization optimizes the program as it will run. Formerly, without linking the program, you couldn't tell certain parts whether you could optimize them or not. So you get extra optimization for that for your money. And this has resulted in a crisp operating system, one that operates very, very rapidly and feels responsive.
What's your default desktop, or do you recommend a default?
Well, our default is KDE 5 at the moment. We can provide LXQT, and we support Hawaii and Western. So we're really up to date on that in that area. We'll have a new release out before March, we hope. Oh dear, this has just fallen off. We'll have a new release out just before March, we're hoping, which will have all these things in it. Our main thrust, though, is Arch 64.
Yeah, this is on the desk is Arch 64 laptop. Well, nearly.
Well, yeah. We had an idea in December. We've always brought a bit of interesting hardware to Fosden.
Yeah.
To engage people, to talk about. And this year, somebody suggested we ought to have an ARM 64 laptop. Now, it was a bit of a joke at the time, but I started thinking about it, and we thought, well, maybe this is doable. So I started looking about, and I found that there was a possibility. So I started doing it. I converted the old Dell Inspiron that I had under the bed, and I put an 18 keyboard.
It doesn't look well. It doesn't look well.
It doesn't look well, does it? But you'd be surprised. If people look at our website in about a month's time, they should be able to see an ARM 64 laptop masquerading as a Dell Inspiron. It's not a pretty sight, but the keyboard works.
It suits the audience, I must say.
And it'll have an 8-core ARM 64 processor in it.
Is this the guts here?
This is the inside.
Says he, pointing at his small little Raspberry Pi-sized board.
Yeah, well, this thing's about 10 times more powerful than a Raspberry Pi. Yeah, it's got 8 cores, and it runs at 1.2 gigahertz.
Okay.
It's got full wireless suite on it, including the aerial. It's got Bluetooth. It's got a camera interface, and it's got three USB ports. You can take it for 8 watts it draws in power, so when you put it in a laptop, it's going to last quite a long time.
Yeah. How much do that set you back?
Well, they're about £90.
That's not much,
But they're just on general release now. You can just about buy them, but we're lucky enough to have one of our developers works for a company who knows a little bit about these things and
fell off the back of a van. Did it?
Well, no. It was distributed for him to make it work.
Yeah, very good. And it wouldn't surprise me. So, anything else that is coming up that you should know about?
Apart from our new release, which, as I've already said, is hopefully be in the spring. That's about it, I think. But we'd certainly like to have some more. More users come along and help us debug stuff and, to report any issues that they might find and help us develop. You know, we've always got space for people who build RPM packages and for developers who want to write code. So, the invitation is open.
I'll just, after this, I'll get some details that we can put into the show notes so that people can go to your project. This is the latest KDE, is it?
This is the latest KDE.
And it also has fixed the ISO 8601 bug.
And this is KDE that was released about 3 days ago.
Okay.
So done specially for the show.
Excellent. So, well, thank you very much for taking the time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Cool.
Hi, this is Ken, and I'm talking to
Christoph.
Hi, Christoph. What project are you with?
I'm working, in fact, with Magia Distribution, Magia Linux Distribution. My nickname, actually, I'm in any Linux distribution and development team, we are known by our nickname. Also, my nickname is actually Eat Dirt.
Okay. And can you tell me what it is, what it does?
Oh, yeah. I guess everybody who knows Linux certainly knows a few names about Linux distribution, like Red Hat, Fedora, etc. So Magia is one of them, and in fact, it's a quite recent distribution. We are right now in our sixth version of the distribution, and it's actually inherited from all the Mandriva Linux distribution, and it's a completely community-driven operating system, and that's it.
And what? It's an RPM-based.
Yeah, it's RPM-based. And also, we have all the tools that actually people from Mandrake and Mandriva developed, like the super nice control centers, etc. And of course, we have much more income from new people that actually add new packages, etc.
So why would I run that instead of running Fedora, for instance?
Well, I think it's actually the good advantage, the best advantage certainly is that it's super easy to use. And I have to say that it's owing to the old Mandriva control center tool. Everything is user-friendly. This DragConf tool is actually centralizing a bit everything for configuring your system. It's very easy to use. It's click. And so you don't need to enter configuration files. So I think it's one of the easiest distribution to get in for newcomers, in fact. So I think that's a great advantage of Magia. And of course, if you are experienced enough with Linux, then it's as good as Fedora in terms of packages and technicity. So
how about support for things like firewalls and proprietary plugins?
For instance, firewalls and even antivirus has actually already accessible to the control center, so you can set up a firewall very easily in a few clicks. Or you can go into more details if you want to play with IP tables. Of course, all these tools are available. So it's really a wide spectrum of usage.
Can you simultaneously edit the config files, or are you forced to use the GUI?
No, you can do everything on the config file. If you are a bit a geek into Linux, then you can play with the config file only. The interface, the GUI, is just an interface, right? I mean, it makes the stuff easy. It tweaks the config files for yourself. And that's it. So if you don't want to be annoyed with config files, then you can completely forget them.
Okay, excellent. And where can I go to download an ISO?
Oh, you go to magia.org, and then it's free download. So you can choose FTP download or HTTP download, or even we are also distributing the ISO on DVD ISO on Torrent.
Is it only i3 at 6 or 64 ARM?
So it's 64 and also 32 bits. And right now we are actually trying to move to ARM, so we are a bit, late into that. Our distro is not fully operational on ARM computer yet, but it will. I mean, for the next release, we are actually creating a repo and have a few machines that compile the packages.
How would you compare it to, bleeding edge Gen 2 sort of? Where do you stand on that with regard to packages?
Well, in terms of packages, now it becomes more specific, right? Because it depends of what kind of packages you are looking at. Yeah. Science packages, art packages, photo editions, etc. Oh, yeah. Well, this is exactly the same for all distro, right? The packages which are widespread widespread usage among the community are exactly the same, more or less, on the whole distro. So in that case, I would say we are completely equivalent to Fedora or even best distro, right? But then if you want to move to more specialized packages, then I would say that we are a bit in advance, for instance, into scientific tools. For instance, we have a few packagers that move into details for amateur astronomy tools. I know that Fedora has a lot of packages specialized to particle physics tools, etc. So then if you are specialized to one field, then you should look more carefully. But we have a few advantages compared to other DAOs.
Can I ask you about how easy it is to first install the system if you happen to be blind or need accessibility help?
Yeah. For accessibility help, we are... If you are blind right now, I don't think you have all the tools required in Magia distribution Linux. But if you have eye issues, then we have indeed all this accessibility enhancement to make, especially on the control center, to make controlling the system easier.
So this is something we are developing right now, which works some more, but of course it's, I don't think right now, if you are blind, you can use, any Linux distribution. Right.
Have you ever tried to install, the distro blindfolded?
I never tried because, I tell you, I think it's almost impossible right now in the current state of many Linux distribution, right? So Magia, I think right now it will be very difficult if you are fully blind to install it. But it's something which is currently developed, right?
Okay, so say we have developers who are willing to help with at least reporting bugs and yeah that sort of thing. How is that something that you'd be open to working with our issues? Because I've seen on some projects there are bugs going back 6 years that haven't been touched yet.
Ah, you mean on accessibility? Or of course, I mean some things that need to be developed. In fact, the Magia control centers and all these tools, you can think of them are already the first step of accessibility, right? If you are a geek, someone which is not able to use a config file is someone who you could see as a problem, right? So in fact, these tools on Magia are exactly this. We have already completely solved the non-expert issue of installing and using Linux, and now our next step is really to go to this accessibility to blind people, etc. But it's difficult, right? You need sound at the installation level, at the first step of the boot, and it has to be debugged, and it's a big business. So it's not easy, but it's something that if developer wants to join on that, I mean, they should actually come.
And if we have the issue with this, of course, is that the developers can't get on board because there's no sound at this level. So is that something that you as a community will at least try and get behind to get the ball rolling to get at least the boot up issue so that we can get developers on board?
There is always sound even at the boot level, right? Your PC speaker is beeping. So even if it cannot talk, you can still transmit information. So, I mean, it's something that just need developers to be done. It's not something impossible. It's really something that has to be done.
How big is your community in general, just?
Well, you should check on the website. Packager, I would say we are not enough because we have like a few ten of thousands of packages. And each of us, we are dealing with 100 of packages. So it's difficult actually to keep on debugging and updating. That's why it's a community driven. I mean, we need new packagers and we have this actually sort of formation system. I mean, if you check the Magia mailing list, then you can just show up and say, look, I would like actually to become packager. And then we have this mentoring program. Someone takes you under his shoulder and then he teach you how we do package stuff in Magia. And after a few weeks, then you can fly solo.
Excellent.
So that's what we want. We want more packagers. So please join us.
While you're here, I guess.
Yeah.
Hi, everybody. My name is Kent Fallon, and I don't know why I'm saying that, because you probably heard that 15 times. I'm here at the Gentoo booth, and I'm talking to
Christian Fiskerström.
Hi, and what is your relationship with the Gentoo project?
I'm one of the Gentoo developers, mostly focusing on GNU-PG and security-related matters in the pack.
Excellent. For those who don't know, can you tell me what Gentoo is?
Gentoo Linux is a meta distribution. By that, it means that it's a distribution, but it leaves all the choices to the user in terms of what should be installed or not. It's a source-based distribution, which is different from a lot of the other binary-based variants. So it's a different way to organize the distribution.
So it's a bit like, more advanced than Linux from scratch, but...
It's not necessarily more advanced in that it's also compiling from source, but it has a package manager that is handling all the dependencies, and you have a lot of one of the biggest strengths in Gentoo is the use flags, which is similar to the port system in BSD, and you have a lot of flexibility, but the package manager is actually handling how to build it, and it's very little overhead for the user in that regard.
Okay, it's a very unique amongst the distros in that it is taking a different approach. How have you found that to be?
For me, that is one of the benefits of using Gentoo, and the reason that I'm using Gentoo myself is that I found it to be much easier to fit my needs whenever I have something that is a little bit out of the box. To have that flexibility in the long run actually makes it easier for me to maintain a system versus doing large gaps. So it's a rolling release, so we don't do releases in Gentoo, and it's more of an iterative process. So it's easier to keep up to date with the upstream when you're developing. It's easier to detect bugs as they are happening rather than to try to go back and look through the history. I think it's a great benefit, but you need to want to be up to date, and you need to want to be on the edge from time to time, because we are running up to date versions of all packages.
For me, when I ran it, it involved an awful lot of work, a lot of maintenance, and adding something as simple as a new media player involved an awful lot of work. Is that something I should have expected?
Well, I'd say that to add something new, as a user, you would use a local overlay, and there are mechanisms in place to handle that. But that would require you to have knowledge on how to write an e-build, which is a package description in Gentoo. And of course, any instructions on how to build a flexible system requires a certain level of complexity to get right. So there is a bar to get into, but at the same time, that is what is providing great strength. And as a user with more basic needs, you don't need to do that part, because that's already being done by Gentoo developers and other more advanced users.
Okay, how did you get involved with the project in the first place?
I started using Gentoo in the early 2000s, so I've been using it for a very long time. I was a long-term user, and I actually started by meeting up with a few of the developers here at Fosdem and getting to know them personally, and just saying that we have a project that is called Proxy Maintenance, where users can contribute packages to Gentoo, but not being a full Gentoo developers themselves. And I was a proxy maintainer for synchronizing key server and a few other packages related to OpenPGP for a while. And then at some point, I just decided that why not become a developer after having been out on a few dinners and meeting up with people on Fosdem and seeing that this is actually nice people. Yeah.
And those are fairly serious topics, the whole security. Do you, you know, what's special about the way you think or do work that makes that... that you find that interesting to code?
I'm not sure if it's something that is very different between Gentoo and other distributions in terms of security, except that because we are a rolling release distribution, we are on the latest versions provided by upstream. That means that we don't need to backport patches and identify security fixes that might not be flagged properly as such by upstream. Yep. So I think that can provide a difference in terms that bugs that are security related but not flagged as such can be fixed again too, but not in other distributions because they are sticking to a lower version. At the same time, of course, being on that bleeding edge means more complexity if there are breakages, in particular in the API. So there is a balancing to that. But I started getting into that mainly for my own benefit, because I've been a long-term user and I'm interested in security. It's to my own benefit to participate in that part of the project, simply because I need to keep up to date anyway. So it's easier to do that directly in the distribution on my own. Yeah.
So can you tell me... why today in Leonard Pottering's presentation he signaling out Gentoo as the only major distro not carrying
System D.
System D.
Just to clarify that we are actually carrying System D, but it's an alternative install. So it's actually possible to run Gentoo with System D, and we have systems in place to handle that. But the default installation, and if you're following the handbook for the initial installation, by default it will not include System D. We are using OpenRC, which is maintained internally at Gentoo, so we are ourselves the upstream of the init system. And it's working. It's working very nicely, and it's sticking closer to the original Unix and Linux philosophy of keeping things small and modular rather than to try to be very large and all-reaching, as some people would argue that System D is.
Do you not find that at a certain point running Gentoo, you're doing your own thing and you're plowing your own furrow, you're using ports, you're not using a standard distro, that sometimes you just go, feck it, I want to run Debian for a while?
Actually, quite the opposite. Whenever I'm on a constrained system, I'm ripping my hair out because I'm not, I can't do things that I normally would do. So I don't like that at all.
Excellent, excellent. Was there anything that we didn't cover?
No, I think that is fine. In the end, it all comes down to user choice. And Gantoo is, of course, one of the choices that that I want users to try to look into. But it is a more advanced system. And the most important thing is that the user is making an informed decision and keeping the systems up to date in no matter what distribution they're using.
Okay, so if somebody wanted to just try Gentoo out for a while, what would you suggest? VMs or...
Well, we are handing out live DVDs here at the stand on FOSDEM. So if a user want to try it out, they can take one of those home.
Build a time machine, go back in time, come to FOSDEM.
Yeah. No, but that is also available on get.gantoo.org so that you can download download a live DVD. But otherwise, as you say, you can set up a virtual machine in any hypervisor and try it out and just start to get to grips with it. The only recommendation I can give then is read the handbook, follow the instructions. It really will make your life easier, and the documentation is great.
And just personal note, you need to read the handbook. I can't stress that enough. You do need to read the handbook.
I agreed.
One of the saddest days in my life was when the Gentoo wiki went away.
Well, since then, the official wiki has gotten quite a refresh, and there is a lot of good contributions that are happening, both from users and from other developers. But we always need help for more documentation work. That is something that we struggle with in all projects that I'm involved with. And documentation is really important for the new user, but it's sadly something that often comes on the backburning when it comes to developing new features and actually programming code. So it's very easy to get a mismatch, and we need all the help we can get better documentation.
Okay, how does somebody become a developer, by the way?
It depends on...
Or how do you become involved in the project?
It depends on the areas of interest. But mainly it's a good idea to start contributing. If you have specific packages that you want included in the distribution, you can go the same route that I did via the proxy maintainer, and you start maintaining a small subset of packages without actually being a Gantoo developer, but working closely with a Gantoo developer that is committing that into the main tree and providing feedback in terms of the e-build and going through the learning processes on that. And after a while, then it becomes natural to look into the rest of it. But we have several variants of Gantoo developers. Some don't have commit access into the Gantoo tree in the first place. They're working more on the things like the documentation and other important things, but not only programming. So you don't need to be a programmer in order to contribute to Gantoo per se. And that is the same for all other projects. As I say, we really need help on documentation, and you don't necessarily need to be a programmer to write good documentation. Quite the contrary, a lot of the documentation is written for users that are not programmers, and as a programmer, it's very difficult to get into the mindset of that user, so we need help from others that think differently.
Okay, folks, you heard it here. Please go and help the Gentoo project. I forgot to ask you how you deal with the accessibility issues within the project.
It's a very important question and something that is easy to overlook unless you have special attention to it. We talked about systemd earlier, and one of the things I mentioned is that internally we have OpenRC, which is the init system. And in terms of accessibility, that is actually the main developer there is actually blind. So we actually have a developer in the core of the system that is blind, and that is of course providing attention to that also for the rest of the distribution. So we have users working closely with the projects to try to support that. But in the end, we are dependent on input from users that have accessibility needs in order to try to predict how that should work. And for a lot of the things, it comes down to the upstream developers of the various packages. So it's not something that we as a distribution necessarily can do on a unilateral basis. But we need to work closely with all the projects providing packages that we are using to improve accessibility. But it's actually a use flag in Gantoo that is called accessibility. So we are trying to establish ways for that.
I can't understand why that's a use flag, because, I mean, you don't build a building and leave the ramps outside as a use flag. You don't leave the lifts not in. Why isn't it there by default?
It might be extra tools that are installed in order to help with accessibility needs that are not necessarily wanted, in particular if you're building an embedded system and are constrained by space and resources. So,
yeah, but if you're building an I have to dig through this. And if you're building
it's a flag, but it's not necessarily disabled by default. So it's a use flag so that it's possible to disable it if you want to have a more restrictive system. But whether it's enabled by default or not depends on the level of added complexity by it, or whether it has additional dependencies and things like that. And that is up to each individual package maintainer whether they want to enable or disable that.
Okay. And would you get on board with the idea of treating accessibility bugs with the same urgency as security bugs?
I think all bugs are important, but not necessarily on the same level as security from my perspective. But then again, I'm working on the security-related packages for a reason. But I think all bugs are important, and in particular when it interferes with the user experience, it's something that needs to be handled with care.
Yeah. But say a high priority accessibility bug where somebody suddenly has no access to their computing environment to order shopping, to do their daily living, I would class that as an important issue.
Certainly, but in question of whether to treat that as a security bug, it's a question of whether you should roll that out in 2 days or a week. And for the user, it's possible to roll back the system to a previous state where things are working again. But that's not possible for a security bug. There you actually need to have the new updated package. So I think there is some difference in the way that you need to approach those issues. But I don't think that comes down to the importance of the user experience. I think that is just a fact of life in terms of how you need to deal with the various issues.
Thank you very much for the interview, and good luck with the rest of the show.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.